Welcome to the Making Money in Multifamily Show, where we discuss everything to do with multifamily real estate investing. We believe it's the best way to gain financial freedom and build lasting wealth. This is where you'll find the best information and practices to help you succeed in your real estate business, whether you're already experienced or just starting out. Here's your host, Dave Morja.
Hello, listener, and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Dave Morja, and with me today is George Abreu. George is the co-founder and CEO of Elevate Commercial Investment Group. He has been investing in real estate for over 15 years. He also started and built his construction company, JNT Construction, which is their in-house construction arm for Elevate. Between Elevate and JNT, they have acquired over 6,800 units, and these numbers may be outdated, George, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but 6,800 units plus, exited out at 1,400 of those units. In total, $500 million plus dollars in assets under management. So, George, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Excited to be on.
Yeah, and I mentioned, you know, kind of the construction background. It's a good niche, I would say, to really start in the business because a lot of people probably don't have that experience. So, where did you, you know, gain that experience? It's probably through the smaller multi, right? So, you want to just kind of give me your backstory there?
Absolutely. So I actually started 16 years ago now with single family investments and doing a ton of fix and flips. And that's where the construction company started because we got burnt a couple times by some contractors. And then the type of scale I was trying to get to just couldn't afford those mishaps. So decided to bring the construction in-house. I had some experience. So an uncle of mine owns a construction company. I worked with him a couple summers at his company. And then coming out of college, I studied electrical engineering. But where I ended up at, which was UPS in their engineering department, it was more of a GC. I mean, I was in charge of expanding the warehouses and just if we had to replace the roof or something like that. So I felt like I had the tools. And so, yeah, that's how it began. And then you're absolutely right. I noticed right away when I started getting into multifamily, which was about 5 years ago, large multifamily, that a lot of the syndicators and deal sponsors really didn't have that construction background. And, you know, yet they're spending millions and millions on these business plans, really just hoping that the property management company or the contractor they hire knows what they're doing. I felt, you know, going into that space that I could add a lot of value with the construction background.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, off the bat, kind of knowing or not knowing rather, whether you're getting a good deal on a project is pretty crucial when you're talking about CapEx or anything like that. So being able to at least estimate that in-house and obviously execute in-house is a huge advantage. My background, similar-ish, where you want to have the right vendors in place. And if you have the wrong ones, they're going to kill you on a deal, right? They can make or break something. So to be able to take that risk and roll it into the vertical aspect of the company, big advantage there. I think a lot of sponsors you'll see start with the PM first. You know, they'll roll into property management first, maybe a little lighter for people to get into, a little bit less moving parts per se, maybe. With that background in construction for you, what was kind of, I don't want to highlight this for too long, but what was kind of like the first few steps that you built out, you know, way back in the day, the 10 plus years ago? Like, what was the first hire? What was the first few things you looked at? You know, what was the business you were trying to grow back then?
Are you saying when I started the construction company?
Yeah, when you started construction.
You know, I just wanted to start the company coming from the investor side, right? I just knew there was a lot better systems that could be implemented. Back then, I mean, nobody was using software with the construction companies. So that was one of the first things we implemented was, you know, going all in on a project management software and tracking everything that way. And then, like I said, coming from the investment angle where if a change order pops up, you know, we're always thinking return on investment. And same thing with the finish outs. You know, we're always going to offer different finish outs, and that would be a better return on your investment. Not necessarily what other contractors would do if they don't understand that side of it.
Yeah. And I guess with that said, because we're talking about basically, you know, where to put your dollars when you're raising for a deal, and where to put the CapEx money, you know, putting in enough, but not too much. So how do you kind of hash out those conversations? Is it, I assume it's not strictly just one-sided from the construction team. I'm sure there's, you know, the investor relations and kind of the underwriting side of the team is also has a play in there. So how do you kind of hash that out to go from, all right, this is too little, this is too much, and hit that final number? Maybe we'll pinpoint it. Maybe like it, just interiors. We'll make it simple to start.
You know, it's definitely teamwork and coming to an agreement on things. You know, our asset manager would love for us to fix every single problem, right? And have no deferred maintenance, no nothing. A lot easier for, you know, him to manage it. And then our underwriter would like us to probably focus everything on renovations and upgrades and boosting up the income. So I think you need to find a good balance there where, you know, you're fixing all the major items, anything that's going to be a headache, anything that residents are going to be upset about and you're going to lose renewals. Then you want to bring safety to the residents as well. You want to work on anything safety related. And then obviously the upgrades, right? That's really the easiest part to see your return on investment, but also keeping it at a certain level within budget, right? Where you're not going overboard and over improving the property.
And at this point on these upgrades, do you kind of have deals that you're specifically looking for to employ this type of upgrade package? I assume you're doing a lot of value add, right? That's pretty much the name of the game still to this day. So are you really like niche down into what type of value add programs you're putting in place? Are you a little bit flexible with business plans because you have the construction arm? How does that shake out for you?
You know, it does allow us to be a little more flexible on things. We do make adjustments here and there, but usually going into a project, we have a pretty set business plan of what we're going to do as far as the CapEx. And then if we get going, like let's say, you know, we plan on fully renovating units, and then we realize that as we go into it, you know, if we just do some slight upgrades, we're going to get the same bump, then, you know, we may make an adjustment like that. And sorry, was there a two part there? I feel like there was.
No, there's no two part. I really just was kind of start to get at like the underwriting process for you guys, like backing out the construction piece and how it kind of targets it, how it kind of leads into, you know, what you guys are looking for deal flow. I hadn't gotten there yet though. Right, so right, you're beating me to it.
Yeah. No. So, and then as far as the deals, we're adjusting there too, right? Especially with the market. Our go-to was heavy value add. The heavier the lift, the more we liked it. We'll still look at those, and we just got to get them at a really, really low basis right now. And then we've also found some niches in the A class where we can add value where it's not obviously such a heavy lift with a newer construction property, but where we're getting just as much on the rent bumps.
What is what's like a heavy lift in your eyes?
Somewhere in the, you know, 10K, 15K per unit. Yeah, probably closer to 15K per unit on a heavy lift.
And probably talking about like re-tenanting the property at least partially, right? I'm sure at that point. Okay.
Yeah.
Just looking to get a feel for things. And then the flip to that, you mentioned the A class. You're investing in it. I see kind of in this market right now, a couple of takes, you know, A class is great to invest in right now because it's, you know, a little bit of a lagging, you know, market trend or versus leading. So I would assume you're probably in the former bucket there, right? You're pretty happy with the A-class performance through an economic downtrend.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have been. You know, we're looking for a certain A-class. Like, I don't want to get, I'm not looking for an A-class deal that's the top of the market and you know, a really, really classy, I guess, A-plus type multifamily property. We're looking for more of just a newer build with some nice amenities. And that one of the key things is most of our A-class properties we're getting straight from the developer, where they're not so focused on getting those rent increases and more focused on the occupancy. So we can come in and tweak some of the management and then begin to get those higher rents.
And so you're basically on a lot of these A-class deals, the first owner, if you will. With your construction background, have you found any bumps along the road, you know, cutting corners on the build, anything like that? Because ideally, you know, in a perfect environment, that development team did a great job, you know, everything kind of checks the box. But I would imagine there's probably a story or two.
You bring up a great point. Look, there's, for some reason, the builders always miss the same things over and over and the same issues. You're always going to have lack of drainage, no matter what. I haven't seen one new property built with perfect drainage. If it's stucco on the exteriors, you're going to want to check your flashings. You're probably going to be getting water somewhere, something they didn't flash correctly. Your balconies, a lot of the times the balconies don't get flashed correctly and you get water penetration from there as well. I would say those three are pretty common for new builds. You also want to check your sewer lines. Even though they're brand new, you get a lot of construction debris that goes down there and you can have a blockage. You can have a broken line from, we've had this happen before where before they poured the concrete, there was, you know, something came loose from the PVC pipes. So the sewer line actually wasn't even attached. So yeah, there are things you need to look for, even in a brand new property.
So all of the ones you mentioned were water related, which is probably, you know, the biggest damaging thing to a property or most things really over time. What is the methodology to do those inspections? Are you waiting for the day after a rainy day? What are you doing to check these things out, during close, before close, all these things?
Rainy day for sure would be great. And that's definitely the
depends
best
on the season
with,
too.
Yeah. Especially with drainage, you know, drainage is hard to tell. Sometimes there's signs, even though it's not raining. I mean, you can look for erosion, with the other items, obviously you can look for signs of leaks inside or even outside. There's some things you can pinpoint with the flashing, and you want to look around your, if you got stucco, you want to look around your windows, around anywhere that the roof meets a wall. You can take moisture meters or infrared if you really want to get technical. So there are some things you can do without the rain, but yeah, if you can go on a rainy day, even better.
Has there been, you know, a project you walked into and you kind of thought you had a winner going in and you had to back out because you just saw kind of too many corners cut, whether it was a new build or something else that you really just, not that you were late in the project, but really just thought you assumed correctly that stuff was kind of built up to par. And then you went and visited for the first time and just saw it was not the case. Anything can ring a bell there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a bit, but I do remember one where we got the LOI and then it wasn't due diligence. I guess it was like a pre-empt due diligence inspection. And the owner, we were dealing straight with the owner on this. We met them out there and we told them, you know, we were going to see every unit during due diligence, but right now we just wanted to see the vacant units. And he was kind of leading the way, and I remember going towards one building, he led us upstairs real quick, and then the corner of my eye I saw something downstairs where I think there was a door open or something. Well, it turns out the whole downstairs, he didn't want us going down there, but I told him, hey, well, I'm gonna go check this out. And the whole downstairs had been flooded, so there was like 8 units or 10 units that were all down. He was trying to hide that from us, which I thought was crazy. So we walked from that one. And there's been think I can remember one other one, but that had to do more with financials and not necessarily the property.
Yeah, that's it's funny because on our kind of tours, we like to kind of have somebody roam without guidance, not to like, you know, mess the property up or anything, but a little bit less of a guided tour can have its own insights, right? Stuff like that, where it's like, oh, you're going to be led this way and maybe the other guy zags. So it's interesting that you say that.
Exactly what was happening.
Yeah. So what's the deal with that deal? Was that more of you just wanted to walk because it was kind of a dishonest seller or because the CapEx was going to be way out of line? Or what was the thought with that one?
It was a while ago. It was a few years ago, but I want to say we were able to just lock it up before we hadn't walked it yet. So we kind of locked it up with the LOI. And then that was just the first time we were walking the property.
Yeah. And you're pretty deep in conversation. So to kind of not disclose that is pretty, pretty interesting. So
yeah. Yeah. Who knows what else they hadn't disclosed. And yeah.
Yeah, sure. So getting more into, I guess, the more typical value add stuff, you know, other than like KMBs, what do you find are like the main drivers for value that, you know, we mentioned that battle between the asset manager and the underwriter and the construction team. So what are the kind of drivers that you guys have found to be working in your markets and, you know, not just like the kitchen and bath upgrades, which are like the easy ones, of course, like what are you guys seeing out there that is kind of working for you guys that, especially given you have a construction arm, you guys can usually put out for cheaper than most other places would.
On the renovation side, you know, other than your typical, taking a classic unit and just doing your vinyl plank and your backsplash, adding smart features, you know, depending where you're at, what, you know, that might not work on a C-class product, maybe depending, but, you can add, I know we got one property right now where we're adding a smart thermostat, a smart lock, and I think, some USB, which isn't necessarily smart, but some USB plugs. And we're asking for 50 to 75 more, I believe, for those, which, I mean, the cost to do that is minimal compared to what you're getting there in value. Other than that, I mean, our renovations are pretty, pretty typical renovations, right? I mean, they're clean, they're nice, but we keep it pretty simple.
And then I guess just backing out the business model even more, you're in Texas almost primarily, from what I remember last time we spoke. Is that going to continue the whole Texas thesis? Is that A, because you have just a good relationship there already? Is it more of just you like the market? How do you kind of feel on that? Or what's the goals the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll go anywhere if it makes sense. We own properties in Oklahoma. We've owned in Georgia. We own in South Carolina. We own about to own in Florida, closing on a few there.
Busy. And then, I like it.
Yeah. And then South Dakota, believe it or not. So that's probably the most random one there. So yeah, I mean, if the fundamentals are there, if the market makes sense, then we'll go there. I love Texas. So the fundamentals of it and the fact that I'm here in Texas, definitely makes it easier. So we're not going anywhere away from that, but we are looking at different markets. Actually, we have a deal right now in Northwest Arkansas is our newest deal. So another new market. But yeah, I mean, we're looking for those hot markets where there's still a lot of room for growth.
And how are you leading the charge to kind of, you know, expand deal flow? That's like a good 7 or 8 states if I'm, you know, doing some finger counting correctly. So how are you kind of leading deal flow? Is that kind of through partner relationships, deal sourcing? Are you growing out kind of more of a lead funnel, like kind of, you know, broker relations? How is that working? A little bit of both, I assume.
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, internally, we've got our director of acquisitions and we've got our relationships. So, I mean, we're constantly getting leads coming straight to us from brokers or developers. And then started a coaching program earlier this year. So now a lot of my students in that program are bringing us deals as well. And that's, you know, how we're able to get into those different markets.
Yeah, I guess that was my next one, is because the bandwidth to be boots on the ground is a little tougher. So usually that lends to a partner in some form or fashion, unless you really just kind of grow quickly and are cool with dishing out salaries left and right. But yeah, partners ultimately at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. No, we definitely have co-GP partners on a lot of our deals. It's usually them bringing us a deal, and then we, you know, help facilitate the rest of it.
And then what is that, you know, I don't want to quiz you too much, more of the structure background, not the underwriting background, but what is that process typically for you guys to kind of get that new deal in the funnel, put it through the wickets? What are the kind of high level things you look for before you even kind of, you know, pass it on to the next person to actually look at it deeper?
Yeah. I mean, there's certain, bullet points we like to look at, and, mainly the market first, right? Cause we don't like the market, then there's no point in looking at the rest. So we'll look at the different population growth, the household income, the total population, what's driving the economy, what employers, etc. If that checks the box, then we move on to the pretty much how much value can we add to it. You know, we look at that by looking at where the rents are right now compared to where the market rents are. We do pay close attention to the purchase price. The going in cap, you know, if it's a heavy value add, maybe we won't pay too much attention to the going in cap. But if it's not, then yeah, definitely we want to obviously try to acquire it at the highest cap that we can. And at a high level, I mean, that pretty much covers it.
How are cap rates in the deals you're finding? Are they catching up with the kind of interest rate hikes? I assume no, cause they're not in my neck of the woods either. So
no, it's slow, man. It's a slow process.
Yeah. you battling with brokers too much, or just kind of waiting it out to see if things soften? How is it for you guys?
We're staying active. You know, we're submitting offers. They're definitely not at the prices the brokers are still wanting. But we're submitting, and we're kind of, we've been in this type of market before, or at least the downturn of a real estate market. So we know a lot of it's going to be follow up. And so, yeah, it's going to take a bit, but I mean, we're still finding some good deals here and there that are starting to pop up.
Are you starting to see like a trend in the feedback you get from the sellers via the brokers or anything like that? I feel like we're in this 6 month window where, like, you know, some people are starting to play ball, but some aren't. So, you know, we're kind of in that transitory little phase here that we've been talking about for like 2 years, really, but seems to finally be here.
I feel like everybody's starting to play ball finally. Yeah. There may be some here and there, but, you know, for the most part, the brokers are telling us, yeah, just submit it. You know, I don't care where it's at. Just give me something. So, I think we're about there.
Yeah. I think part of that too, just thinking about it from the broker's lens, is I think the offers submitted per deal is plummeting for them. So they're wanting offers in, even if they're low, cause it's, you know, that's a KPI for them. So if they can't get offers on the table to the seller, they're not looking too hot either. The deal we're closing, there was only, you know, probably a third of the offers normally submitted. So it's definitely an issue for them to get those in right now. So it can't hurt.
Yeah. In the last few months, we've had so many brokers calling us, wanting to take us to dinner. Like, it's, you know, 6 months ago, they were nowhere to be found. But
Yeah. It's kind of the way it goes. The shoe lands on the other foot, maybe for a little bit here at least. So we'll see how it pans out. But yeah, very interesting. Is there anything else on kind of the construction piece, just to, you know, kind of circle it back, that you found over the years? You know, we mentioned it's kind of your kind of unique value prop, right? So what have you found that's kind of helped you along the process? And that's kind of a general one. So where has there been like a specific case where you were like, this experience kind of saved our bacon on a deal or this or that, that you thought like, if someone else was in my position, they probably wouldn't have caught that, or we probably wouldn't have been able to execute that deal or whatever.
Man, there's a lot there. So, sure. you know, definitely some of the heavier lift projects that we've taken on, I feel with how much work we put in on the front end and the type of inspections we do, a lot of things would be missed by maybe another operator. And then the speed of which we're able to start and finish a CapEx project, I think has done a lot for our success.
And this one just popped to my mind. We're talking about, you know, kind of the CapEx stuff, but, you know, investing multiple states, you know, the same team, does that mean you guys have travelers, or are you hiring out your, you know, your on the ground people for different projects in different locations? How does that work for you guys?
Both. So all of our site supervisors and project managers travel. You know, it's part of their roles and their responsibilities. And then we do have several crews that also travel to our projects. In a new market, we'll start off with the traveling crews, and then usually we begin to create relationships there locally, and by the time we end, it'll probably be just local crews.
Yeah, at least from like my background, usually is the case. It's you can't completely just rely on local labor, because, you know, their procedures might be different than yours, but the skills are the same, right? So you just kind of have to show them the how instead of the what, essentially. So, yeah.
And the smaller markets are really tough to find good local crews too. So on some of those, we just bring our crews and leave them there.
Yeah. The demand in the local markets, if you maybe have one good show in town and they might be busy, right? So kind of SOL there. Yeah, George, appreciate this. I'd like to tackle these five key questions, though, before we run out of time, as long as you're ready.
Sure. I'm ready.
So the first one, if you could pick one trait that explains your success, what is that trait and why?
I would say persistence. I'm very, when I get something in my mind and I have a goal, I'm not going to stop till I get it. I'm going to be persistent about it, and that's paid off.
Yeah, it's the just learn to kind of fall forward, right? You just keep going, you'll get there somehow, some way.
Yep.
And then what is the most uncharacteristic thing you have done in your business, and why did you do it?
Ooh, uncharacteristic. I would say, this will probably maybe shock some people, but being the face of the company and speaking at events, doing podcasts like this, that is not my natural state. So I've definitely had to come out of my shell and, you know, go all in.
Yeah. I think, it's not natural for anyone to like to be in front of a mic, like very, very few subset of people. Like even the extroverts that call themselves extroverts aren't really actually good at this. And I don't even think I'm good at this still, but yeah, eventually it gets easier, even if it's not perfect. So.
It does.
yeah. And then can you name a time where you felt like you were not going to end up successful, and how did you overcome that fear?
I think maybe right before getting into multifamily, and I kept trying to scale the single family side of things, and I wasn't getting it to where I wanted to get. And then I was spread pretty thin, had a lot of things going on, had the construction company. And then I had within the construction company, I had different arms of the construction company. And it was one point where I was spread really thin, and I kind of questioned what I was doing, and it was a great moment because it's what led me here and got me to really focus. But yeah, it was a little tough for a little bit.
So maybe that'll lead into the next one, but can you name a time where something in your business went perfectly, and what did you do to make that a reality?
Say it one more time. When something went
pretty much the flip to that. Can you name a time where something in your business went perfectly, and what did you do to make that a reality?
Okay. I would say all the work that you know, I just talked about the speaking at events and the podcast. And so it took a lot of work to get that credibility and to start doing all that. And then once it kind of all clicked and came together, you know, our growth just exponentially grew from there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Especially rewarding, you know, when it's something you didn't feel like doing to begin with, right? It's like you've been harder work. So, like, you know, the payouts
be better
larger,
work, right?
Yeah, that's great. And then last one here, what have you been focusing on lately, George, to improve yourself or your business?
Ooh, what I've been actually, I hate to keep focusing on this, but I mean, a lot of it has been public speaking. I've somewhat conquered that fear now, and now I'm trying to take it to the next level where I'm actually good at it and use techniques and whatnot. So been reading several books on it and trying to get better.
Just real quick, without putting you on the spot too much, what name a technique, if you would, to maybe help someone starting out.
Ooh, somebody starting out, be yourself. A lot of people think, you know, you got to be someone else, you got to put on this show. Honestly, the audience rather see you be transparent and be yourself. Just do it.
Well, and the funny thing is, and then you go meet that person who you heard being fake online in person, and they're not even the person you thought they were to begin with. So it's like you're losing all value there anyways at the end of the day. So
exactly.
Yeah. No, George, I appreciate it, man. It's interesting to hear your background in construction, how it's folded into, you know, the multi and development space. But just in case the listener wanted to reach you today, how could they find you?
Best way, you know, we update our website constantly. So that's elevatecig.com. You can find a bunch of free content on there. And if they want to shoot me an email to George or Jorge, it's jorge@elevatecig.com. I can send over pretty much what I call like an arsenal of free content, everywhere from construction checklists to questions to ask the property manager, etc.
Arsenal. I like it. George, appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the show. I don't take your time and attention for granted and appreciate that you would spend it with me. If you enjoyed this show or any of my previous shows, it would be a huge help if you would rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting service, or even just share the episode with a friend. And if you'd like help from me or would like to talk about real estate investing further, feel free to visit the show notes for more information, or you can visit davidtravis.com.